Chapter 2. The Dynamics of Being. Being is not really a very Buddhistic word. It is rather too static. The word we should be using is becoming. In fact, the subject of this chapter is the underlying dynamics of our becoming that make nonsense of the term being, which we commonly apply to this process. In more traditional terms, we will be concerned with the links of conditioned co-production, which chain us to a continuous cycle of rebirths, and with how the Buddha's analysis of this process offers us an ever-present opportunity to bring it to an end. It must be admitted that the topic of karma and rebirth is not as fashionable in Buddhist circles as it used to be. In view of the central importance of this teaching to all schools of Buddhism, it is probably worth examining how this has happened. If we find that one aspect of the Dharma appeals to us strongly, it's usually because there's some imbalance in ourselves, a certain need in ourselves to which that aspect of the teaching corresponds. And if there are aspects of the Dharma that we leave on the side of our plate, so to speak, then it may be that those aspects correspond to aspects of ourselves and of our experience that we are not yet prepared to address. While it is certainly appropriate to follow our own personal bias to some extent, we need also to be aware that the bias is there and that an adjustment will need to be made at some point. We can take a balanced view of the Dharma only if we ourselves become psychologically and spiritually balanced. Karma and rebirth in Western Buddhism. In little more than 100 years, the Dharma has come to appeal to people in the West in a wide variety of ways. And the different elements, aspects and schools within the whole, sometimes bewilderingly complex body of Buddhist teachings have not all found the same general favour at all times throughout this short epoch. Different teachings, different schools, have come to the fore at different times according to the different cultural conditions in force at any one time. If we look at how Buddhism came to the West, we find first a period of purely scholarly interest connected with the growth of Orientalism. This movement of fascination with all things Oriental arose in the wake of the vast colonial interests exercised by various European states, particularly by Britain. The study of Buddhism was often initiated by civil servants who were simply concerned with gaining a deeper understanding of the local administration. For instance, T.W. Rhys-Davids, the great Pali scholar, developed his interest in Buddhism when, as a judge in Ceylon in the 1870s, he had to delve into the Vinaya to clear up some rather complex questions of Buddhist law. Then, from the close of the 19th century, a few Westerners began actually to call themselves Buddhists and to take up Buddhism as a way of life. Finally, Buddhism may be said to have definitely arrived in the West when, at about the beginning of the 20th century, Western bhikkhus and bhikshus started to appear, when you got not only Western lay people, but also Western monks. Those aspects of Buddhism that appealed most strongly to the first Western Buddhists are nowadays often of more peripheral interest to people. Judging by the Buddhist literature being produced 80 or so years ago, Westerners at that time, at least those of the English-speaking world, were attracted to Buddhism, if at all, mainly by three things. Firstly, by the personality of the Buddha, as a teacher, as a historical figure, as a wise and compassionate human being. Secondly, by the ethics of Buddhism. And thirdly, by the Buddhist teaching of karma and rebirth. And it seems, judging now from my own experience, that it is not these aspects that are decisive in bringing people to Buddhism today. There are both negative and positive reasons for this change. To begin with, One cannot isolate the history of Buddhism in the West from Western religious history in general. That Westerners should take up Buddhism at all may have seemed eccentric or even bizarre in the eyes of many at that time, but such an exotic development still partook of the Western religious zeitgeist. During the second half of the 19th century, this zeitgeist was deeply informed by scientific discoveries, particularly by Darwin's The Origin of the Species, by the higher criticism in biblical studies, and by the study of comparative religion. As a result, Christianity in its traditional dogmatic forms became less and less intellectually acceptable to a great many sincere and reflective and even spiritually sensitive people. At the same time, such people retained a strong emotional connection with Christianity. They could emancipate themselves intellectually from the dogmatic, doctrinal side of Christianity, but their heartstrings remained tied to the beliefs, practices, customs, and traditions of their childhood and youth. For these people, Christianity had originally meant three things. This is especially true of the evangelicals, who were prominent in English religious and even social and political life in those days. Christianity meant, in the first place, devotion to the person of Christ as the Saviour, as the incarnate Son of God. It meant an ethical code by which they could shape their actions, the Ten Commandments of the Old Testament, and the Sermon on the Mount of the New Testament. And finally, Christianity gave them the hope of life after death. It is hard to appreciate nowadays how strong and pervasive this belief in life after death was in the 19th century. But I remember when I was a boy of 14, I was sent down to the West Country to stay with some elderly people in a rambling old house, decorated and furnished in the style of the 1860s and 70s. And what I came away with, above all, was a memory of the pictures hanging in the bedroom where I was put. They were huge framed images of a single religious theme that exercised our Victorian forebears perhaps more than any other. One showed angels welcoming the departing soul into heaven. Another was of a bevy of angels having what appeared to be a little gossip. And yet another depicted the heavens opening and a faithful soul aspiring upwards. They all inspired, or attempted to inspire, a hope of the life to come. Probably the best known literary illustration of this sort of thing is Dickens' pathetic description of the death of poor little Nell in the old curiosity shop. How the snow was falling, and as she passed away, the voices of the angels could be heard calling her to her everlasting rest. It is all laid on with a trowel, which is how the Victorians liked their sentimentality. So even after many people felt obliged to abandon Christianity as an intellectual proposition, they still hankered after something equivalent to those three elements in Christianity that had meant so much to them. And some people found them in Buddhism. In the person of the Buddha, they found a non-theological Christ, a historical figure with all the virtues traditionally associated with Christ, even perhaps a few more, but without the encumbrance, not to say embarrassment, of Trinitarian theology. In the Buddhist precepts they found a code of ethics without any supernatural sanction, with, if anything, a purely humanistic sanction. They found the Sermon on the Mount without the mount, that is, without the dogmatic doctrinal background. Finally, they found in the teacher of karma and rebirth what appeared to them to be a more rational basis for their hope in a future life. It is this final point which would come as something of a surprise to most traditional Buddhists. In the East, the idea of having to come back again for another lifetime, after the flames of your funeral pyre have died down, is accepted implicitly. No one ever argues about it. No one ever discusses it. It's just accepted. It's taken for granted that you keep coming back to the world for lifetime after lifetime. But rebirth is also viewed as a terrible thing, having to endure all the limitations of a human body, all its pains, all its sufferings, over and over again, is regarded as a miserable sort of process. The blessed release of Nirvana represents for most ethnic Buddhists essentially freedom from rebirth. In the West, by contrast, a century ago, it was the prospect that after death there would be no life, just annihilation, that was the most terrible thing. The teaching of karma and rebirth, even taken in isolation, represented some sort of salvation, the possibility of escape from this terrible post-Christian nihilistic predicament. That Buddhism should thus have been effectively treated as a sort of Christianity substitute is only to be expected at that intermediate stage in the development of Western Buddhism. It is hardly possible to jump all at once into something totally new, totally strange. You have to go down into it step by step, gradually assimilating it, accommodating it, harmonizing it. You have to go to the unknown from the known. Today, however, the position is rather different. The majority of us who come into contact with Buddhism are not so heavily conditioned by Christianity that we are looking, whether consciously or unconsciously, for a Christianity substitute. We are post-Christian. We are not so much reacting against Christianity as simply registering that it just doesn't mean much to us. We no longer, for example, think of religion in terms of devotion to a person. This was an integral part of religious ideology in the 19th century, and is an integral part of the faith of many Orthodox Christians even today. But as Western Buddhists, we don't think of religion in those terms at all. We are not searching for someone to worship. We are not looking for a relationship with a person. In a Buddhist, this is not just a spirit of rebellion. There is a positive and clear principle involved. To those who were devoted too exclusively to his person, the Buddha used to say, "He who sees the Dharma sees me." It is only when we understand the Dharma, the principles and practices taught by the Buddha, that we can truly see and understand the living embodiment of those principles and practices, the Buddha himself. A further simple reason for the shift of interest from the person of the Buddha to his teaching is that we have far more of the Buddha's teachings translated into European languages than people had even 50 years ago. If we are no longer looking for a Christ substitute, neither are we looking for an ethical code. We may need some guidance in the way we lead our day-to-day life, but not a list of do's and don'ts. We get so many conflicting moral messages from various quarters that most of us made the decision long ago to assess for ourselves what is right and wrong. We tend to sit loose to any systems or codes of ethical behaviour. Most of us work out our positions on moral issues and how to act on them simply by rule of thumb. In the case of Buddhists, a more positive reason for the less central importance accorded to ethics is the greater attention paid to meditation. If one had been reading books and articles about Buddhism 100 years ago, one would have found plenty of discussion of ethics and very little reference to meditation. Nowadays, one would find the direct opposite. It's not that ethics are necessarily neglected, but it is understood that ethical behaviour is important not only for its own sake, but because of its effect on the mind, effective meditation being possible only on the basis of a good conscience. So too with the question of life after death. This is simply not the preoccupation for people that it used to be. In the 19th century, it was a burning issue. But nowadays many people seem to be able to contemplate, with some degree of equanimity, the possibility that after death they might not continue to exist. Their interest is centred on their present existence, here and now. More positively, we may say that the present generation of Buddhists are less interested in karma and rebirth because they are more concerned, at least theoretically, with realisation here and now. As a result of this existential emphasis, Zen Buddhism gradually replaced the Theravada in popular esteem from about the 1950s. And while Zen itself has now taken second place to Tibetan Buddhism, Western Buddhists seem to remain resolutely uninterested in karma and rebirth and unimpressed by the whole future prospect of life after life after life. However, the process of karma and rebirth, as described in Buddhist tradition and depicted in the Tibetan Wheel of Life, is worth studying, whether or not the question of future lives is an important one for us, because it can be seen not only according to the timescale of lifetimes, but on a much smaller scale, reflecting the way life unfolds from day to day, even minute to minute, and suggesting how we can choose the direction our life will take. We will take a brief look at the workings of karma in our chapter on ethics, chapter 10, but here we will focus on the process of rebirth, taking as our guideline the 12 links of becoming, illustrated by the outermost circle of the Wheel of Life. The 12 links of becoming. The process of rebirth in Buddhism is analysed and understood according to the principle of conditioned co-production, otherwise known as dependent origination, or in Sanskrit, Pratitya Samutpada. As the English translations suggest, this principle explains the origin or production of the various factors of our experience, how they arise in dependence on preceding factors. Thus it represents the application of the general Buddhist philosophical principle of universal conditionality to the process of rebirth. It is analysed down into a number of nidanas, or links, in a series, each of which arises in dependence on, or is conditioned by, the preceding one. A few texts enumerate the 5 nidanas, and a few others identify 10, but the standard number is 12. Such inconsistencies may make the whole way the nidana chain is enumerated seem rather contingent, but this is as it should be. Lists of this sort are not to be taken too literally. It is a mistake to think of a particular subject as being literally divided into a specific number of parts. There is not a literal Buddhist path, for example, consisting of literally 8 distinct parts. These are divisions just for practical convenience. So discrepancies between different texts as to how many nidanas to count should remind us that conditioned co-production does not divide itself up into a number of actual links as such. The nidanas should help us to understand the spirit of conditionality rather than pin it down in a set, particular framework. There are innumerable factors operating on the individual at any one moment. The nidanas represent simply a selection of crucial ones, and, as conditions do, some of them appear more than once. Of the 12, the 1st and 2nd traditionally refer to the previous life, the 11th and 12th to the following life, and all the rest to the present life. 1. Ignorance, avidya, is not literally the first nidana because there is no actual beginning to the chain, but it is in some ways the most important. It is not ignorance in the intellectual sense, so much as a lack of spiritual awareness, or even, if you like, a lack of spiritual consciousness, a deprivation of spiritual being. Metaphorically speaking, avidya represents a lack of illumination, a state of mental and spiritual darkness. Ignorance in this sense is the direct antithesis of bodhi or enlightenment. Just as enlightenment or nirvana is the goal of individual human development, the mountain peak ahead of us, so ignorance, lack of spiritual awareness, represents all that lies behind us in that process, the deep valleys swathed in darkness, out of which we are gradually emerging. More specifically, avidya is made up of various wrong views, wrong ways of looking at things, For example, seeing the conditioned as unconditioned, thinking that anything mundane, anything phenomenal, can last forever. Such a view is not an intellectual conviction, of course, but an unconscious assumption. In clinging on to things that are subject to decay, and therefore becoming unhappy when we finally have to surrender them, we behave as though we believed that they ought to last forever. Another specific instance of avidya is belief in a personal God as supreme being. The idea that belief in God is a case of lack of spiritual awareness might raise a few eyebrows. But on this question, Buddhism offers the same view as does psychoanalysis. This is that the God figure, the idea of a supreme being, a creator, is a sort of projected father figure, a glorified representation of the father of our childhood, on whom we depend for help when we get into difficulties. Such belief is seen as a manifestation of spiritually immature dependency and unawareness. Ignorance can also manifest by way of various beliefs, whether rationalized or not, based upon the assumption that purely external acts, such as ceremonies, rituals, and sacraments, can have spiritual efficacy or value quite apart from the state of mind with which they are performed. An obvious pitfall to avoid, one might think. However, even today, there are, for example, many Orthodox Hindus, even educated and westernized Hindus, who genuinely believe that the waters of the Ganges have a definitely purifying effect, and that if you take a dip in those waters, then your sins really will be washed away. And of course it can never be like that at all, as Ramakrishna, the great Hindu mystic who lived at the end of the 19th century, used to explain. He didn't like to offend the feelings of the Orthodox, but at the same time he didn't like to commit himself to the Orthodox belief. He would say, "Yes, it's quite true that when you take a dip in the sacred Ganges, you are purified of all your sins. When you go down into the water, your sins take the form of crows, and they perch on the trees nearby. Though, when you come out of the water, the crows disappear, and your sins come back to you again." Thus, it is really quite difficult to dislodge this wrong view, particularly when it is entrenched in a venerable tradition. In the West, the 16th century Reformation inaugurated by Martin Luther was basically about this question. It was about whether the whole sacramental side of religion, and in particular the purchase of indulgences, which relieved the purchaser of the burden of their sins, had value and efficacy in themselves as purely mechanical external observances. Luther asserted that it was impossible. Yet it is still one of the teachings of the Catholic Church that the sinfulness of the priest in no way impairs the efficacy of the sacrament he administers. This is avidya. Above all, it includes ignorance of the law of universal conditionality itself, the law which is exemplified by the principle of conditioned co-production. Two. Karma formations, samskaras, arise in dependence on ignorance, or avidya. Samskara literally means preparation or setting up, and when it appears in the context of the five skandhas, i.e. the five aggregates or categories into which the self, or what one thinks of as the self, may be analysed, the term is translated as volitions, or willed action. But in the context of the 12 nidanas, it is generally rendered as karma formations. This means the aggregate of those mental conditions that, under the law of karma, are responsible for the production, or preparation, or setting up, of the first moment of consciousness in the so-called new life. Essentially, the samskaras are acts of will, connected with particular states of mind. These states of mind, which may be expressed either in physical action, or in speech, or just in mental activity, are either skillful or unskillful. Unskillful mental states are those dominated by greed or craving, by hatred or ill will, and by mental confusion or bewilderment. Skillful mental states are those dominated instead by contentment, generosity, kindness, and clarity of mind. Unskillful volitions result in what is popularly called a bad rebirth, while skillful volitions result in a good rebirth. However, Buddhism takes the radical view that both these kinds of volition, skillful as well as unskillful, are ultimately rooted in ignorance. According to Buddhism, desire for a good rebirth, or even working towards a good rebirth, is just as much a product of ignorance, in the spiritual sense, as moving more or less unconsciously towards a bad one. This is because rebirth, even a good rebirth, isn't the goal of Buddhism. The goal is the complete emancipation of the mind, or consciousness, or whatever one likes to call it, from conditioned existence itself, from the whole round of birth and death and rebirth. The traditional image given for the relationship between avidya and the samskaras, whether skillful or unskillful, is a rather pointed one. Avidya, or ignorance, is said to be like the state of drunkenness, while the samskaras, the karma formations, are like the actions that you perform while drunk. In effect, this image suggests that most people, in their ordinary, everyday actions, even in their so-called conventionally religious actions, are no better, from a spiritual point of view, than inebriates behaving in the foolish ways that inebriates do. This is really the state of most of us. Sometimes it is said that, from a spiritual point of view, we are asleep. But it is just as true to say that we are drunk. We're drunk because we are continuously under the influence of ignorance, so that everything we do, everything we say, everything we think, is the product, in one way or another, of that lack of spiritual awareness. A drunkard imagines that whatever he is doing and saying is very clever and witty and wise, when in fact it is simply sottish. We are the same. Whatever we may do or say or think, however we may indulge in all sorts of charitable activities, all sorts of conventional religious practices, it is all done out of lack of spiritual awareness, which is quite a sobering thought, really. And yet, in dependence on this drunken activity, arises consciousness. So what does this mean? 3. Consciousness, vijnana, arises in dependence on the samskaras or karma formations. But this isn't consciousness in general. It is consciousness in a specific sense, called technically the relinking consciousness. After the death of the human organism, it relinks the psyche to the psychophysical process in the form of a new life, a rebirth. According to tradition, 3 factors are necessary for conception of a human being to take place. First, there has to be sexual intercourse. Second, the prospective mother should be ready to conceive. And third, there must be what is popularly described as a being ready to be reborn. Being here means the last moment of consciousness belonging to the previous existence. In other words, it is the relinking consciousness. According to the Theravada school, there is no interval between death and rebirth. But other schools, the Sarvastivada, and following them the Tibetans, teach that there's an intermediate state, a bardo, in between. This intermediate state forms much of the subject matter of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, or Bardo Todol. Which of these views is correct is open to debate. However, the more important issue is whether or not anyone may be said to be reborn at all. This question exercises many people. In view of the doctrine of Anatman, or no self, who or what exactly is reborn? As usual, Buddhism offers no facile solution to this conundrum. All one can do really is point out two extreme and thus false positions to be avoided. One extreme view is to maintain that the person who is reborn, who reappears in a new existence, is in some essential way the same as they were before in their previous existence. So if someone is reborn, well, it's the same Tom or Dick or Harry or Gertrude or Mary as before, only they are kitted out with a new body. This sort of belief is expressed, for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, where Sri Krishna says that rebirth is just like putting on a set of new clothes when you get up in the morning. You cast aside the old, worn-out body and take on a new one, but you yourself remain essentially unchanged. The other extreme view says that no, you must be an essentially different person in your next life. The influence or the conditioning exerted by the body on the psyche as a whole is so profound, i.e., your physical experience is so fundamental to your identity, that you cannot speak in terms of being the same person when you have a different body. These would appear to be the only alternatives on offer. Either the person reborn is the same as the one who died, or they are different. However, we can begin to discern the real nature of these two views on rebirth by stepping back to another controversy with which they are connected historically. This is an ancient Indian dispute about the nature of causation, and the two opposing schools survive to this day. The Satkaryavada school of thought maintains that cause and effect are identical. It says that when a so-called effect is produced, all that has really happened is that the cause has changed its form. They say that if, for instance, you have a lump of gold, which you make into ornaments, then the gold becomes the cause of which the ornaments represent the effect. And in that case, both cause and effect consist of the same thing. It is the same gold, whether you call it cause or whether you call it effect. The process is uninterrupted, and there is no specific point at which a cause turns into something different, called an effect. Thus, cause and effect are one and the same. By contrast, those who follow the Asatyakaryavadin line of reasoning say that, on the contrary, cause is one thing and effect is quite another thing, and they use the example of milk turning into curds to prove their point. However, both these views, if they are pursued logically, make causation impossible. Whether cause and effect are really identical, or whether they are different, either way there can be no relation between them. Hence, Buddhists avoid this whole argument. They see it as proceeding from wrong premises. Buddhism establishes itself on praticca samutpada, or conditionality. According to this principle, any phenomenon whatsoever, whether mental or material, arises, independence on, or is conditioned by, a complex of other phenomena. But this relationship between the conditioning agents and the object of conditioning cannot be described either in terms of identity or in terms of difference. Neither category fits. Applying this principle to the question of rebirth, all one can really say on the subject is that independence on the karma formations of the last life, consciousness arises. To ask if someone is the same as or different from the person whose karma formations provided the conditioning necessary for their existence is beside the point. The question does not make sense in Buddhist terms. The one who is reborn is neither the same as, nor entirely different from, the one who died. As so often with Buddhism, the really strict orthodox Buddhist position consists of a paradox. There is birth, but there is no one who is reborn. That's the Buddhist position in precise terms. What no Buddhist should be said to believe in is reincarnation, i.e., getting into a body again and again. This notion assumes that you have a soul, a sort of unchanging essence of yourself, that pops into one body after another. Such an idea does not conform with Buddhist principles at all. Technically, the correct word is not even rebirth, but punabhava, again becoming or re-becoming. 4. The psychophysical organism, nama rupa, literally name and form, but roughly translatable as mind and body, arises in dependence on the relinking consciousness. Nama rupa comprises the 5 skandhas: the physical body, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. This is a comprehensive link in the chain, representing a basic breakdown of the individual's full experience of himself or herself into these 5 categories. It is clear from this link that the chain as a whole is not a simple sequence of causation, but a complex chain of conditionality. So certain factors appear more than once in the chain as the crucial element in a whole complex of conditions. 5. The 6 bases, Shadayatana, arise in dependence on this initially embryonic psychophysical organism. They are simply the 5 physical sense organs, together with the mind, which is treated as a sort of 6th sense organ. Just as our 5 senses each have their range of objects, so does the mind have its memories, ideas, and projections. The 6 bases are so called because they constitute the bases for our experience of the external world, the external universe. 6. Contact, Sparsha, arises in dependence on the 6 bases of the psychophysical organism. Contact or impression represents the mutual impact of sense organ with its appropriate object. The eye comes into contact with visual form, the ear with sounds, and so on. And of course, the mind comes into contact with mental objects or ideas. 7. Feeling, Vedana, arises in dependence on sense contact, and we've already met it as one of the 5 categories comprising the 4th Nidana. Feeling or sensation can be pleasant or painful, or it can be neutral, that is, neither pleasant nor painful, and it is an ever-present element of our experience at whatever level, right up to enlightenment. However, whereas pleasure may be experienced at any plane of existence, pain is possible only in connection with the gross sensory level. 8. Craving, Trishna, literally thirst, arises in dependence on feeling. There are 3 kinds of craving: Kama Trishna, thirst or craving for sensuous experience; Bhava Trishna, craving for continued existence, especially continued existence after death in heaven; and Vibhava Trishna, craving for non-existence, for annihilation, the desire for oblivion. This particular link is the crucial one of the whole series. Why, we shall see shortly. And it appears as the 2nd of the 4 Noble Truths, the origin of rebirth and suffering. 9. Attachment or grasping, Upadana, arises in dependence on thirst or craving. One might well imagine that this Nidana needs no introduction, that we are all familiar enough with attachment to pleasures of all kinds, to possessions, to people, and so on. However, what we usually think of as attachment represents only one of 4 kinds of attachment enumerated by the Buddhist tradition. The second kind is a particularly significant and characteristically Buddhist idea of what constitutes attachment. It is attachment to drishti, literally view, but also meaning opinions, speculations and beliefs, including all sorts of philosophical and religious opinions. This is not to say that you shouldn't entertain beliefs or convictions or philosophical or religious opinions, even very strongly. But attachment or grasping or clinging to them is seen as unhealthy. How then is one to tell the difference between a strong, healthy conviction as to the truth of one's views and an unhealthy attachment to them? In fact, it is quite easy. When we are engaged in argument with someone and they challenge an idea that for us is axiomatic, if we become in the least bit upset or angry, then that is a sure sign of attachment to drishti. If our equanimity is at all disturbed when our belief is challenged, then whether our view is right or wrong is no longer of much consequence. That clinging is a fetter, binding us to the wheel of birth and death. Let us by all means rectify and refine our understanding of the Dharma and try to put it into practice, but not in such a way that when anyone questions or challenges us, we feel threatened and react in a hostile, unsympathetic manner. Thirdly, there is attachment to ethics, sila, and religious observance, vrata. Again, it is not that one shouldn't practice ethics, meditation, and so on. The mistake is to cling on to one's own practice as an end in itself, or to imagine that doing these practices makes one different from other people. And then fourthly, there is attachment to a belief in a permanent, unchanging self, existing apart from the various and constantly changing elements of one's experience of oneself. 10. Becoming, bhava, arises in dependence upon attachment. Bhava is life or existence as conditioned by our attachment, on any plane, on any level, from the lowest hell realms to the highest celestial abodes. The term bhava can be taken to mean conception, but it also refers to the whole process represented by the nidana chain in both its passive aspect, consisting of the fruits of action, and its active aspect, consisting of the volitions that result in rebirth. According to some Buddhist schools, including those of Tibet, this link represents the bardo, the intermediate state between death and rebirth. Others would say that it represents the intrauterine period of human life, that is, the period between conception and birth. 11. Birth, jati, arises in dependence on becoming, in its active volitional aspect. Some would say that this is literally birth in the sense of becoming physically independent of the mother, but it can also be seen as the simultaneous coming together of the five skandhas as a psychophysical organism in the womb. 12. Decay and death, jara marana, arise in dependence upon birth, together with, the traditional texts say, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Once you've been born, well, nothing on this earth can prevent you from decaying, eventually, and dying. We are born out of our attachment to conditioned things, and we must also go the way of conditioned things. Breaking the chain. The wheel of life, and this sequence of 12 links, can be taken symbolically to mirror to us the process of actions and their consequences which drive our behaviour from day to day. The very act of reaching for a biscuit can be analysed in terms of these 12 nidanas. But we can also take the sequence as a literal reflection, a pictorial teaching of the process of birth, death and rebirth. The 12 nidanas cover a sequence of 3 lives. The first 2 links, ignorance and the karma formations, belong to the past life, in the sense that it's because of spiritual ignorance and the actions based on that ignorance that we're born again in this life. Consciousness, name and form, the six bases, contact, sensation or feeling, thirst or craving, grasping or clinging, and becoming, all belong to the present life. Birth and subsequent decay and death obviously belong to the future life. These same 12 links can also be subdivided into two groups, known as the action process and the result process. The word for action here is karma, using the word in its simplest sense. The links belonging to the action process represent what we do. They are volitional actions, whether of body, speech or mind. Whereas the links belonging to the result process are passive, representing what we experience as a result of what we have done. Ignorance and the karma formations constitute the action process of the past life. It is as a result of them that we have come into existence in the present life. Consciousness, name and form, the six bases, contact and sensation or feeling, together make up the result process of the present life. They are the givens of existence, the results of our past actions. There's nothing we can do about them now. Thirst or craving, grasping or clinging, and becoming constitute the action process of the present life, because they are all volitional and therefore productive of future karmic consequences. Thus we have, over the three lifetimes, past, present and future, an alternating sequence of action process, result process, action process, result process. Within this cycle, there are three points of transition. The point where the action process of the past life is succeeded by the result process of the present life. The point where the result process of the present life is succeeded by the action process of the present life. And the point where the action process of the present life is succeeded by the result process of the future life. All these three points are extremely important. The first and the third represent the points of transition from one life to the next. The second point, however, is a point of transition which is, in a crucial sense, even more important. A point of transition in the midst of our present life at which we can potentially move from the cyclical type of conditionality to a completely different spiral type. This is the point at which the wheel of life can cease to revolve altogether, the point at which we can break the chain. But how does this happen? We have seen that the last link of the result process of the present life is sensation or feeling, pleasant, painful or neutral. It is perhaps worth noting at this point that by feeling here is meant no more than the bare sensation. It doesn't mean boredom or love or anger or anything like that. These we could refer to as emotions rather than feelings, to make the distinction clear. There's nothing wrong with feeling, nothing wrong with sensation. In fact, as we have seen, it is part of the result process. We have no choice about whether or not we experience it. Where we do have a choice is in how we respond to that pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral sensation. Of course, we don't usually experience it as a choice. It is usually automatic that in dependence upon feeling arises craving. That's the problem. Of the three kinds of craving, craving for continued existence and craving for annihilation are impulses, opposite tendencies, really, of which we need to become aware. Generally speaking, each of us tends either to the extreme of eternalism or to the extreme of nihilism, extremes that distort our whole world view. These tendencies go very deep, but they are clearly in evidence in our everyday life. For example, in that we tend to take either an over-optimistic view of things or an over-pessimistic one. It is of the utmost importance that we become aware of our own tendency in this respect, and aware that it will be colouring our view of life. But it is the third kind of craving, thirst or craving for sensuous experience, which gives us the clue as to how we can break the endless circle at this point. Perhaps to speak of craving is slightly misleading, because the connotations of the word suggest that it is simply desire for pleasant experience that is meant, whereas craving here includes three distinct strands. When we experience a pleasant feeling, our usual tendency is automatically to want to hang on to it. When, on the other hand, we experience an unpleasant feeling, our reaction is to push it away, to avoid it. And if we experience a feeling that is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, we are liable just to feel confused. In other words, we are infected by the three root poisons, greed, hatred, and ignorance, symbolized at the hub of the wheel of life by the cock, the snake, and the pig. These are the forces that keep the whole wheel spinning round. When we respond to pleasant feelings with thirst or craving, to unpleasant feelings with aversion, or to neutral feelings with indifference, we set up volitions, we create fresh karma, and round we go again. This is why this particular link is so crucial. We have to learn to experience feelings and sensations without allowing them to give rise to craving, aversion, or indifference. Here, mindfulness, awareness, recollection, is of fundamental importance. It is important that we are able to be mindful or aware of what we are experiencing in the way of sensation or feeling, rather than reacting unconsciously to that sensation and thus setting up unskillful volitions. Creating this hiatus can be very uncomfortable, because once we become aware at this point, we realize that craving is essentially impossible to satisfy. Although our instinct is to grasp pleasure and push away pain, our longings will not be appeased, nor our pain stilled in this way. Out of this realization of the essential unsatisfactoriness of mundane things, dukkha is the Buddhist term for it, can arise faith in the possibility of something higher. Faith, we may say, is the positive counterpart of craving. This movement from the awareness of unsatisfactoriness to faith is the first step on the spiral path, and this is the starting point of Chapter 7, in which we will examine another sequence of 12 links, a sequence that forms not the endless round of the wheel of life, but the spiral path, which begins with this moment of awareness between feeling and craving, and which leads us away from the wheel of life through more and more positive states of consciousness, all the way up to enlightenment itself. These 12 positive links, as one could call them, have often been forgotten. They are mentioned in only 2 or 3 places in the Pali Canon, and as far as I know, they are not mentioned in the Mahayana scriptures at all. We hear a lot about the first set of 12 links, but we hardly ever hear about this second positive set. This is unfortunate, because it contributes to the impression some people have that Buddhist spiritual practice is primarily negative, consisting simply in getting rid of craving, clinging, and so on. It's therefore important not to forget the 12 positive links. They represent the spiral type of conditionality, and without them, our picture of reality as represented by the principle of conditionality, is incomplete. Moreover, without them, the spiritual path has no rationale. There is also a great deal of value in contemplating the 12 links that make up the cyclical trend of conditionality. Indeed, every serious student of Buddhism needs to be well acquainted with them. We should be able to recite them from memory, almost like repeating a mantra. The Buddhist tradition teaches specific methods of reflecting and meditating systematically on the 12 links, and we need to make the effort to do this. One could go so far as to say that otherwise there's not much hope of our really understanding what Buddhism is all about.